Federal Reserve, University of Chicago study that found that big banks devote only 2.5% of their commercial loans to small borrowers and only 0.7% to very small borrowers, which is defined as those with less than $1 million in bank credit. By contrast, small banks, by contrast, make 82% of their commercial loans to very small borrowers. You also have the problem of diminishing, just still on a consumer standpoint, the problem of diminished consumer choice as a result of this stuff. You've got fewer companies, you've got fewer options, and they tend to make more money by diminishing consumer choice. One way to think about this is an example of the long-distance market, where, or in telecommunications generally, when there was a single monopoly, AT&T, they had most of the technologies, or some form of the technologies that are now becoming the information revolution, like fax technologies and cell phones and all that stuff, a few decades ago. But there just wasn't any serious incentive to bring them to market. And when competition opened up, that changed dramatically. And that happens in a number of other areas. Microsoft is another good example, where they exert their monopoly power to destroy competitors who might introduce competing kinds of technology, new ways of doing things, either through anything from word processing to the operating system to browsing to the internet. And then there are also cases where you've got consolidated corporations actively conspiring to suppress technology that would be beneficial. In the 1970s, there was a case brought against the auto manufacturers, then just three because the Japanese weren't much of an influence, for suppressing air pollution or air pollution emission technologies that would have led to cleaner air. They didn't want to introduce it because it would have cost a little bit more. Then, finally, there's this core issue of political distortion, the political effects of concentrated market power, concentrated corporate power, concentrated economic power. I think that is the critical issue for us, even though it's taking me a long time to get to it. Now, one way to look at it is just that we all know that big companies exercise more influence over politics than small companies do. That's a fact. No one seriously can dispute that. And it is the most important issue that we've got to grapple with. But there are a variety of ways that show how this stuff takes place in a more concrete fashion. Well, here's one example. This is actually my favorite example of this. Citibank and Travelers merged. Citibank is a bank. Travelers is an insurance company. It is illegal under U.S. law for a bank and an insurance company to merge. But they did it anyway. So it's corporate civil disobedience. They did it because there's a two-year window in which they can do it. They get to pretend it's not happening for 2 years. It's going to be reviewed for 2 years. But then the 2 years ends, maybe they can get an extension for a couple more years. But at the end of the day, it's illegal. They can't let it happen. And the antitrust authorities, the banking regulatory authorities, cannot let it happen. So no one wants to merge for 2 or 4 years. So what are they thinking? Well, they're thinking they can get the law changed. There's a law that now prohibits the merger between banks, insurance companies, and securities firms. And that law is probably about to be obliterated this year. Something known as financial services reform. I work with Ralph there. We're not allowed to use the word reform in the office. It's always deform. So that's one unbelievably concrete example. I mean, that is what's going on. Another critical area is defense. So as you all may have heard, the Cold War is over, and we ended that a little while ago. But the defense budget is at the same level it was at during the Cold War. The Clinton administration has courageously suggested, because before the Kosovo War, the Clinton administration has courageously suggested that we raise the defense budget by $112 billion over the next 6 years. Why is that? Well, there are a variety of reasons, but one of the important ones is that the defense industry, with the U.S. government's encouragement, is consolidated into three major companies, Boeing, Raytheon, and Lockheed Martin. And they just have unbelievable influence. And they do clever things, like they contract out a lot of their business, and they make sure they've got contractors in every state. So there's a lobby, there's a local lobby in every senator's state, and most congresspeople's districts, to upgrade the defense budget. And that's just a lot harder to do if you've got a more decentralized industry. Another problem that comes out of this that's more in the area of political issues or corporate welfare issues is that when you have mergers, you get the creation of companies that are what are called too big to fail. The biggest example of this is in banking, where the concern is, or it happened with Chrysler. Chrysler was such a big company in the late 1970s when it was in trouble, the government really couldn't let it fail because the employment effects were too serious. So they had to bail it out. Now, I just think that was the right thing to do, given the circumstances. But the problem is getting yourself in a position where you've got these companies that are so large that if they get into that problem, they have de facto free insurance from the U.S. government. And that, in ways that are slightly more elaborate, is a very, very serious problem in the case of banks, because the concern is the failure of any one bank would set the whole financial system tumbling apart.
Isn't there a recent example of that? Was it with Travelers, or was some major bank or insurance firm that was going to fail and the government bailed it out?
The most prominent one was a strange investment company called Long Term Capital Management.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Which is a hedge fund, which is an entity that borrows huge amounts of money, invests it all over the world, invests money that it doesn't own. Invests in futures with the expectation that the markets are going to go certain ways. When the Russian market collapsed, so did Long Term Capital Management. It turns out that they were investing $4 trillion, which was no small amount of money, and that had to be sort of cobbled together. That's exactly right.
In the 1980s, all the savings and loans, they're not all, but a lot of them went bad when the federal government came in.
That's right. And it's exactly the same thing. Although there was a little bit less an issue of corporate concentration, although there had been a fair amount of concentration in that industry compared to what had been. It was more a deregulation problem where a lot of small players all did the same wrong and bad and criminal thing.
Yeah, that long-term capital was $4 trillion? Right. The government bailed them out for $3 billion.
That's right. The numbers are very strange. They didn't have that much money, but they were investing based, they can borrow like 100 even more times. They can invest up to 100 or more times what they actually have. So there are different ways to estimate. But you're right, the bailout was not on the order of $4 trillion. That's outside the money. The system would have collapsed, if that didn't require. There are other clear examples of this. Boeing, for example, exercises, which is now the only jet manufacturer in the United States, thanks to the Federal Trade Commission ignoring this system and acquired McDonnell Douglas a couple of years ago. Boeing controls basically the country's China policy. So everything we do with China is, except bomb the embassy maybe, is for the benefit of Boeing. In the area of the biotech, there's been some, I'm sorry.
Can you just, why is Boeing controls China?
Why does Boeing care about China? Because yeah. Boeing is sourcing huge amounts of its production in China and they want to sell to the Chinese market, which I think correctly is going to be the biggest market for jets. Boeing, especially a couple of years ago before they had recent sort of manufacturing problems, Boeing was this great leading American company, the biggest exporter, improving our trade deficit, all this kind of stuff. So they exercise really power beyond what is the role in the economy.
They're also a military contractor.
And post, they had always been a military contractor, and post acquisition of McDonnell Douglas, they're now a huge military. They're now the second biggest military contractor. Exactly. In the area of biotech, a lot of us probably been here having discussions about how you've got Monsanto and a couple other companies buying up the seed markets and having all kinds of potentially very serious effects that go beyond the traditional kind of lobbying thing. You have the problem of imposing genetically engineered seed on farmers because there's really no place else to go, for example. And in the case of the media, you have the kind of issues that Norman was mentioning in his discussion today, where all the major TV companies are controlled by outside forces, GE, Disney, and Westinghouse, so CBS is now sort of independent. But they also control most of the cable networks, and then you've got a couple other companies that are the major players, like Time Warner, that control the rest. And as a result, we have a narrow, to put it modestly, set of views presented to us over the mainstream media. And there are also quite considerable issues going on with market shape and political issues regarding the internet. To take one example, there is a, and people here may know more about this than me, there's an internet delivery technology called DSL. Anybody familiar with that? We have one person who knows DSL. It's like, it's much faster than using a modem, so you get very fast, very high speed internet service if you get DSL ones. And they go over, the benefit of them, one of the benefits is that they go over the existing telephone line, the existing copper line. So a couple of the local phone providers who own those copper lines, so for example.
It's not the telephone, it's the cable line.
DSL is the telephone, it's not cable. Cables, there's a different corporate concentration issue. There's a couple of the local phone providers are getting into this market, including Bell Atlantic, which is my phone provider in Washington and on the East Coast, and SBC. Is SBC the phone provider here, or is it a different one?
US West.
They control these copper lines, and there are small companies that say, look, we can deliver this technology, but we got to get access to the copper lines. So the Bell Atlantic, say, is willing to give, or SBC, is willing to give them that access, but they charge them at a rate, well actually, when they provide it to them on their own, they charge a zero rate. And when they charge these other companies, they charge $25 a month. The result is, because they have a monopoly control over the copper lines, and there's no system of any kind of regulation, they are able to price out competitors, and they're going to have a de facto monopoly on this technology, unless the regulators say they've got to price it fairly to the competitors. Now, I think that's an interesting example, if it made any sense to you, which is maybe it didn't for those who don't know the technology. It's an interesting example because it suggests that there are antitrust issues beyond what I'm talking about that go to how markets are structured. Other countries don't talk about antitrust policy, they talk about competition policy. And they look more broadly at market structures. So under this would come this kind of issue about how you regulate these copper lines, or also whether you would maintain the existing ban on mergers between banks and securities firms and insurance companies.
Is that a good example of a vertical merger, or not a vertical merger, but vertical control is having an influence on the market?
That's right. And so there's this host of other kind of competition issues that we need to think about. You don't want to get in a position where you make a virtue out of the market. There's a zillion reasons that we don't want to live in a market-dominated society, and we don't, as progressives, want to say that the market is the vehicle that we rely on to deliver social justice. At the same time, it is the case that competition decentralizes economic power and decentralizes political power. And we need to think about how we encourage competition, encourage corporate deconcentration in a very serious way. I mean, just if you want to talk even about local control over economy, very difficult problems. And you've got, for example, your major utility now owned by a Texas company. What do you do about that? Is the state going to take it over? It's pretty difficult. It would be much better to stop that merger, right? So I think those are some of the things that are it would be profitable to think about as progressive activists. And the key thing is going to be, I think, one is finding ways to do this that aren't so distant. So if you're in Portland, you don't have to worry about going to have a meeting with the Justice Department in Washington, but you can focus on the state attorney general. And the other is trying to create a political context where this stuff resonates with people, where you don't deliver it in an hour presentation like I did or whatever it was, but you do it in 10 seconds, right? And I think we need to struggle to come up with ways to do that effectively. We have a few minutes left, and you can tell me what you think. I have some thoughts, but certainly no solutions. And the political context is important, I think, for a variety of reasons. The political twist to this is important for a variety of reasons. One is that even though the federal regulators say they decide things on the basis of this, politics is really decisive. Exactly, actually, as you were pointing out. And where they have political pressure, they're more prone to do the right thing. So we created actually quite a bit of political pressure on the Staples office depot merger. And it enabled the authorities at the Federal Trade Commission to do what they wanted to do, but felt intimidated from doing in the absence of political pressure in the right direction. And it also changes the overall political climate. And I think talking about it and talking about corporate concentration and demanding government intervention to force deconcentration helps promote the idea of citizens' control over corporations and locally based economies, which I think is a shared understanding here of what we need to move towards. That's my end, so raise your hand.
Well, what I would like to see happen is corporations be treated equivalent to a human being, or even less than a human being, because they should be less than a human being. Now, a human being lives so long, they die. Corporation should be terminal, too. It should have a certain lifespan, it should die. And, or it should come up for review to see if that corporation should live. And from what I understand, it's about 100 years ago or more, just shortly after the Civil War, there were some laws passed or some judgments made in the courts which gave corporations more power and the individual less. And this has to be reversed. So instead of us acting like little children, going to the corporation and saying, please don't do this, you know, I don't want to get spanked, you know, or something like that, you know. I mean, you know, they're up there and we're down here. I mean, it's got to be reversed. And that's the point I'd like to make.
Well, I agree with you. I completely agree with you. I'm not totally sure what your thrust is. If you're saying that should be an alternative to what I'm proposing here, then what I'm saying is kind of irrelevant. We should focus on the root question. Or if you're just saying that we additionally have to have this perspective.
Well, I'm saying that we should, what you're doing is not irrelevant. But
okay.
Sooner or later,
here,
make any real progress, you know, we're going to have to confront the corporations and not the beg them and say, please don't.
I agree, but this is, first of all, it's not a please don't strategy. This is telling them what they're going to do, and it is a real world existing, and this is my point of view on this question, so I agree with that perspective, but I don't think that the agenda can be we've got to take away corporations' rights, period, because that's not going to happen anytime soon. It's a direction that we should move towards, but I believe this is something that takes us in the right direction, and it's a here and now available option to do it. There is an antitrust enforcement agency. It does block mergers from time to time. And it is a critical shaping of the corporate form and the corporate entity itself, which is the issue that you want to get at. Now, you want to is more or less true that corporations had fixed periods of life, an earlier period of formation. And why is that an unreasonable idea now? Why do people say that's not plausible? Well, partly it's because we're all brainwashed. But partly it's because what does it mean to say to Exxon, you've got to close? Exxon can't close. Society cannot have Exxon closed. It's too big. So I think one of the things we need to do is move towards smaller companies, smaller entities as a prerequisite to achieving the more fundamental thing that you're rightfully talking about.
There are a couple questions. One is, what does it mean that you exerted political pressure on companies so that the FTC can do what they want to do?
Well, we did. It was kind of funny. I mean, we started to get involved because a guy saw an ad for this, that there was going to be this Staples Office Depot merger in our neighborhood. He got pissed off because he bought the Staples and knew the prices were going to go up. And he said, we're not going to let this go. So he got engaged. We did this little price study. We compared the price of fax paper at different Staples around the country. And it got incredible news media coverage, just kind of sort of consumer price thing tends to get very good coverage. And all of a sudden, there was just this huge interest in it. We had USA Today calling us. We had all these stock people calling us. Actually, the day we released the study and it started to look like the price was going to go down, the value of Staples in the stock market dropped by $1 billion. We didn't spend that much time on this stuff. And we organized people to write in to the FTC. Actually, because of some of the work we've done, you can now send in comments on any proposed merger. They've got ways to do that. Before, it was impossible even to send in comments. So it wasn't huge political pressure. I mean, it wasn't, for example, anything like Forrester Adams in here. It was much less. It was much more momentary. But in the context of antitrust in the last decade and a half, it was unprecedented. And because it was a bad merger anyway, even by traditional terms, they were inclined to act against it. Also, I must say, they were inclined to act against it because they were weaker political parties. I mean, weaker political actors, just smaller companies. So it's much easier for the FTC to stand up to Office Depot and Staples than it is to Exxon and Mobil. I'll come back to you later. Yeah,
is there some critical upper limit to the process that we've been talking about here? Could the mega corporation go through some kind of qualitative change in the future to become, if they start behaving like a nation state, for example? Did you ever have any favorite nightmares?
Well, I think that they do. You know, we don't respond that way. We've got HMOs that make literally life and death decisions about people. What more powerful decision does government exercise? They can imprison people. In fact, well, we got private prisons too. So, so I think that does happen. That big corporations are governments in a lot of ways, not just by size, but in a lot of decision-making roles they play. And will it qualitatively change if they get bigger? I don't know, but I think it's sort of happened.
I don't see why this merger phenomenon should be so surprising to anybody. Just about everybody at this conference today is aware that there's a class warfare going on. You've got the corporate capital class grinding the labor class into the ground. And one of the ways they do it is they control our electoral process with all the money they have. Anybody doubts that can look at all the money that's spent and how the person who spends most of the money usually wins and where that money comes from. So you've got all the elected officials and appointees put there by the corporate class. So what you have is a situation of is these regulatory bodies being filled by people that are beholden to the corporate class. So if you don't have a situation of the fox guarding the hen house, you've at least got the hen house being guarded by people that were put there in power by the fox.
I'd like to talk about the form of business a little bit more. Is there any difference when you go to an owner-operator forum, like I'm thinking of the Mondragon cooperatives, do they actually fit into society in a better way, or are they more caring and careful of the environment?
Well, I'm certainly no expert on Mondragon. Are you? Can you tell us about that? Mondragon is a network of cooperatives in Spain. It's the largest producer of cooperatives, not just consumer cooperatives. And it is a serious force in the economy. It's not just a small a bookstore here or a food shop there. And it's been held out as a real model how to do things differently. I think from a little bit I've read, it seems that it's clearly different in a variety of ways, but it's not paradise either. Workers seem to definitely do better. They do seem to be more integrated into the community, but how much so, I don't know. Just don't know enough about it.
When the regulatory bodies set aside this formula and allow some of these mergers to happen, I have a couple questions kind of for this. On what basis do they make that decision, I guess? How do they justify that? Is it related to their how they define efficiency? And the other part of this is, does that then become precedent in terms of law? And are we just kind of digging ourselves into a deeper hole?
Those are good questions. They justify it in a couple. Usually they say they take into account efficiencies. And they say, well, even though it looks bad this way, it's really going to create efficiencies in the economy. We'll be better off at the end of the day than it would have been in the absence of a merger. Now, according to the law, they're not supposed to take efficiencies into account. But they decided to ignore the law. It's an old law, so it's kind of evolved. It's hard to hold them to account. So that's the main way to do it. In the case of the Boeing McDonnell Douglas merger, which was unbelievably, I don't have the numbers here, so I can't show you the rapid extent of it, but it sort of blew this whole system out of the water. We let it go through anyway, and they used the excuse that even though McDonnell Douglas wasn't a failing company, there's an exception for failing companies, it wasn't really a significant competitor anymore, and therefore it didn't matter. They just made up a new doctrine for it. It was a very sort of intellectually weak effort. And is it a precedent? It's not a formal precedent. It is a precedent. There's a judicial decision that says what happens is if the FTC or the Department of Justice intervenes to try to stop the merger, they have to file a lawsuit in federal court to do it. And then there's unless the merger falls apart on its own, there's a judicial decision. If that is made, then that is a precedent. If the FTC, let's say the McDonnell Douglas Bell merger goes through, it's not a formal precedent in any way, but of course, it looks stupid if they do things that contravene it too directly. Yes?
What I don't understand about all this is if corporations keep getting bigger and bigger and we're charging more and more for things, which has been happening, capitalism works on you buy and sell, you make a lot of money. And who's going to be buying all this stuff? I mean, I know, because so many people have been downsized and they've been laid off and they have nothing. They've got minimum wage jobs now and people's wages are going down and all that stuff. And then in Latin America and Asia, where are the markets been? Who's going to buy all these products they're producing? If our pockets are empty, I mean, here in the United States, we still have a semblance of, we have a middle class still, but in a lot of countries, the middle class is devastated. So, I keep thinking, are they on their own death march too, the corporations? they're going to be producing goods that nobody can buy, or I don't know.
Well, no one knows for sure. My sense is that you're right, that they are. A lot of them think that they are, but it's a systemic problem where no individual can say, well, I'm going to produce less, because they don't get anything out of that. Even if they think the system, the whole industry, say, or the whole system is producing too much. It's a huge problem, for example, in autos, where there's clearly overcapacity worldwide. But no one can start producing less, because it doesn't mean there's going to be less production. It just means they forfeited market share. And for now, my read on what's going on in the economy is that this problem is being offset by the rise in the stock market, and you've got an elite class of maybe 20% or maybe, I think, comfortably quite less in the United States that has significantly increased buying power in the last few years because you've got this bubble in the stock market. If that bursts, as I think it inevitably will, it's hard to see how the economy is going.
My sense is that it's been true for some time that there's been a qualitative change in the attitude of corporations toward the American people. It goes beyond quantity of just counting numbers and these sizes, but perhaps they go together. But there's the sense, I have never seen anything like this in my lifetime, but there's a sense in the last 10 or 20 years that corporations are now in control. And I've never had that sense so strongly before. Although I knew they were behind the scenes and doing all kinds of things, and they were very powerful. It's as though the corporations do things out in the open now that they wouldn't dare have done 20 years ago.
I agree.
And it's almost with contempt. It's almost with contempt now, because it seems they control the media, they control everything. And it's as though they can ignore us now.
I think that's right. I think there are two strands to it, one of which is related to antitrust, which is what you were just saying, which is that there is a degree of corporate power in Washington that is certainly at its height in the post-World War II era, or at least since the Depression, really. And it's maybe ever, I don't have a good enough read on that. I'd say they're clearly more influential than they were in the Reagan era, and obviously more in the Nixon era, which was a fairly progressive period, as it turns out.
I sense the qualitative change. I think most people around here do also.
Yeah,
there's been a change.
I guess
right now, the ball game is quite different.
And there's a related issue, which is what you first raised, which is the relationship to American people versus, in other words, their national loyalty, which has been dramatically eroded over exactly the truth you're saying. That's related, in fact, to their increased political power here. Yes.
Yeah, you talked about the antitrust report from AFC. I'm wondering, like, how they're appointed, and what their prerequisites in education might be, and what their duties are. I mean, are they like the crackers, the corporate bucks, kind of fighting chicken, you know? Are they like, do they like wait until something comes up and then they're appointed to work on that? Or like, do they sit and like just watch corporations and get paid to police corporations?
Well, I mean, they work hard. Most of there's two sets. So there's the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission. At the Justice Department, the head of the Antitrust Division is always going to be a lawyer. And I don't know if everybody at the Federal Trade Commission is a lawyer or not, but certainly most are going to be. Joel Klein, who's the current head, I mean, they're both, again, they're appointed but often by the president. But the Justice Department is more of a political appointment than the Federal Trade Commission appointments. Joel Klein, who's the head of the Justice Department Antitrust Division, came out of the White House. Well, he was a staffer there.
They're corporate lawyers, originally.
Most of them are. But, I mean, almost without exception, every sort of anybody who's called a lawyer in government is a corporate lawyer. And there's a few exceptions. So, for example, Bob Petoskey, who's head of the Federal Trade Commission, is an exception. He came from academia. He was the dean at Georgetown Law School prior to being appointed. Yes.
Northrop Lockheed merger, is that dead or is that going to come back? Or?
I think it's been stopped. I think it's gone.
Now, how did the mobile Exxon, was that the one?
That's still pending.
I mean, that's so insane. $75 billion.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things we said when the oil merger prior to that, the big one, was DP Amoco, which has now been approved. And we said at that time, Federal Trade Commission should intervene to stop this merger, because if this merger goes through, there's going to be more mergers. And I think that's I wrote about this in an editorial in the Monitor that's over here, but I think this is an important principle, and it's part of the antitrust laws. It's called the incipiency doctrine. But the basic idea is that one sets off a chain reaction. You should stop it before it starts. And partly it's the reasons that I said. A lot of it's just fat. But indeed, it has happened. Led to ExxonMobil, and of course, BP is now trying to buy Arco. And Chevron and Texaco are talking about merging.
I heard, say, one to three things that we could do to have specific actions we could take within the next week that we could actually do?
Well,
or is something like that listed on
one
of your websites?
Well, my favorite thing, of course, would be to tell you to support the small bookseller Common Courage by buying my book. But it's actually pretty hard to say, and a lot of stuff is case by case. I mean, look, ExxonMobil merger is still outstanding, and it's unlikely that letters from citizens are just going to affect it. But at the same time, it's how we fight losing battles to later fight winning battles down the road. So you could, you could write a very informed letter based on your understanding of how this HHI thing works. Or you could just say, look, what are you, crazy? And send them a letter. That's fine. They should hear that. If there's a sentiment that the public has reached its limit on corporate mergers and corporate concentration, that will actually affect them. They don't think that, but I'm sure. It will affect it. So that would be one thing to do. If you like doing stuff electronically, you can go to the webpage at ftc.gov and there's a way to send them notes.
I don't think that we might reach a limit. I think they don't think we care.
That's correct.
Or are paying attention.
They think we don't care, and if we do care, it's exclusively about the issue of consumer prices.
Right. And that's the only thing. 8 people in the entire country.
No, consumer prices they think we care about.
Okay.
People, they understand. For example, I mean, there are other examples that I didn't give. But one, maybe this is the wrong crowd to give this example to, but in a different crowd, if I said, do people not like their cable companies? People here have cable companies, I don't. Do people use cable, right? A few of you do. Right? You all get bad service, you all know that you're paying way too much, it seems unreasonable. You also know that you don't have any choice, that there's one company. That resonates with everybody. Everyone understands that who has cable, which is 2/3 of the country. So people are sensitive to these price issues, at least.
Isn't a lot of this a note on free enterprise, and I'll probably get in trouble for this one, but isn't this a lot of this caused by these companies were subsidized, like General Electric was getting $10 million a year in the 80s for doing research and development, and doesn't it also, I thought Spinoza said that in a free enterprise system, monopolies were illegal in a free enterprise system because they restrict trade, they do just what you're describing. And one other thing is, in the movie Wall Street, he said that these guys don't own what is it, the board of directors don't have any stock in these companies. Is that true?
I think those things were all true. It is true that if you really believe, from my point of view at least, that if you really believe in free markets, you should be a strong proponent of antitrust, which sometimes makes me feel stupid for being so concerned about this stuff. But it's not the case that any of the right-wing think tanks in Washington support antitrust enforcement. And mostly they just hate government, they just taxes for business, I think, which is the reason for that. On the board of directors, that is largely true.
Isn't that a disconnect that should be hit home harder? I mean, that the right wing is, you know, speaks of market forces as an ideology that we should all believe in, the Chicago school. We should let the markets go, get the government out of it. But then, if the government gets out, then the mergers get much worse, and the markets are much less free. There's much less of a market. It seems like that disconnect isn't brought home to the right very much.
Yeah, I think you're right. Even I didn't know. Yeah,
I guess I'm just curious if you have any examples of past successes in terms of legislation or political movements that we could sort of use to mimic, a current political movement. Like, for example, the Community Reinvestment Act in 1977. So, yeah, I forget what I'm familiar with. But I guess I know we have had some successes in the past. I'm curious how those came about and if we can't mimic those now or in the future.
There aren't any good recent examples of campaigns around legislation for antitrust because there hasn't been any meaningful antitrust legislation since 1914. There was something important passed in the 1950s called the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act, which is what leads to this. It requires emerging companies to report to the government. But there aren't a lot of good examples. There actually is a fair amount, if you want a congressional strategy, there is a fair amount of interest in this stuff in Congress, especially because a lot of you get victims that are able to find allies in Congress. So especially in the Midwestern states right now, for example, a lot of the farm state senators are very wound up about antitrust enforcement because there's rapid consolidation in packing industries and so on. And that's leading to farm prices plummeting. And so the farm state senators are wound up about this. But in general, my view and my pitch on this is that it's just like any political movement. If you've been involved in any political movement, you know the drill. And I also think that it's a long-term issue. It's not a campaign around any particular piece of legislation, although there are legislative fights. It's really about trying to make this a political issue and bring it the fact of bringing it to the consciousness of people public will change the climate pretty quickly.
On that note, I'd like to say that tomorrow afternoon is when there's a Measure F meeting like this where they talk about local communities and what you can do in the local community in terms of organizing people to rethink the corporation. So.
One thing just to reiterate again is I think the more winnable campaigns are the state level. They're quite winnable in a lot of cases.
First of all, tell Ralph
Nader
that we want to
be here for the
test.
Do it seriously.
I think you should be vice president.
I'll be sure not to tell him that.
But anyway,
Ralph, like, thanks for really ginned up for you in Portland, man. I'm running with you.
So you know, Winona.
Forget Winona.
We're not actually intrigued by the idea in 2000 again also. I spoke with her last month.
But I had another comment.
Go ahead.
That was the most important one, of course. But I'm just a little confused because you just said that there was no important antitrust act since 1914. And then that made me think of the whole breakup of AT&T, which was like, what, 82? So what was that all about? I worked in telecommunications, and I look at it all now, and I go, why did we go through all this? Because now they're all merging back together.
Well, that's a separate question, but by act, I meant law. So there hasn't been an important law passed. The critical law was passed in 1914, a couple others. By act, I did not mean action. The breakup of AT&T was significant action. And I think on balance...
What was the point of that? When now everybody's merging back together and all the banks are merging, I mean, was there like a totally different mindset? 20 years ago, and now all of a sudden they don't care about it anymore?
That's why.
Or what, have things changed so much? Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say that in terms of the raising for the corporate people, there's going to be a global street party. I know there's going to be one in Eugene, I'm not sure about Seattle or Portland, but cities all over the world, and I think about 40 countries right now are planning big demonstrations against financial centers and corporations. So there's a website, I think, that look up for like RT at Street Behind the Street.
But I have to bring in. Go in here, go in here, Beautiful, or go to the closest one. But
I think it's going to be quite big,
and it's going to get a lot of attention. If it gets into the media, it's going to be. Until we're running out of time, so just one question, maybe, before I let you off. Yeah, I'm just going to. Are there any resources where an individual consumer can find out what, like, they have a particular product, they have a choice of two or three products. I want to know. Which of those products was manufactured by a company that's owned by a corporation, that's owned by a corporation and on a chain? So I can make choices and say, I want to buy the one that's made by the smallest company.
Yeah, there's a book that I'm not that big a fan of that does this sort of called Shopping for a Better World by, you know.
But it changes all the time.
I don't think that one's been upgraded. It probably doesn't address actually what you're talking about. And I don't think there is anything that does.
Dun & Bradstreet, you can
figure this stuff out through Dun & Bradstreet. And if you go onto the SEC website, you can see who owns everything. But you can't carry your laptop in or the big Dun & Bradstreet. Go to the supermarket. Thanks very much.